Access number 32394, Miss Don Farrington, rail 6. Now, the next thing is, on the 17th of November, 1944, you moved to join 90 Squadron as part of 3 Group of Bomber Command at Tuddenham. I'm not sure where Tuddenham is, but...
It's near Newmarket.
Okay. Now, tell us about that move, because it's your first squadron, isn't it? Now, what was the reception sort of like? What do they do when you join the squadron?
It was a very basic... it was not a recognised airfield, in as much as it had been... I've forgotten what the name is now. For one of the types of stations, which is... I'm sorry about this.
Right.
This is the one thing, unfortunately. They called it a certain... It wasn't like a normal squadron where it's all like it used to be peacetime. There's a lot of peacetime squadrons. Now, the unfortunate part about this, because it was... I wish I could remember the name
of it. It doesn't matter.
But... what it was, because it wasn't one of the fully standard type squadrons
regulars.
That there were, regular squadrons, it was one of these that had been made, so because of the amount of aircraft that were being used at the time, they posted people and decided that they were going to build these other squadrons, but in this case... it hadn't been completed. So what we got was very basic accommodation. Accommodation in the sort of the huts that we had was very, very basic. And we had no hot water on the camp at all. So we can tell sort of it was in the state of still being finished. So to us it was a very, very shock, a great shock, because you come to expect when you go into a squadron which is operating that at least the accommodation would be all right. But... in this case, and bearing in mind it was winter and we were freezing, so a lot of the time we were wearing some of our kit, even though we weren't flying, because the conditions were really at that stage quite basic, and a lot of people. However, the thing was that the station was operating. And I think the first thing that after we got more or less acclimatized, they were working, the work people were still there putting all the hot water elements and electricity and all these things were being done while we were actually operating. And slowly but surely, they got it okay. And once we got the hot water and the other facilities, it was okay. However, in the middle of all this, of course, it still didn't stop flying duties, which was the main thing.
And what was your reception like? You know, you join a new squadron. How did they sort of make you welcome, sort you out?
The reception, I cannot remember a thing about it, to be us being honest. All I can remember now is the conditions that we arrived at. I'm thinking to ourselves, well, I hope to God we're not going to be in conditions like this while we're flying as well. As I say, eventually that came right, but I think what did make an impression on me was that while all this was going on, the rest of the squad who were already there, squadron people, one of the things that we first saw when we were there was the blokes coming back from a raid they'd been on to Berlin. And I've never seen such weary people in all my life, and they were all coming back, and they looked as, I mean, they did look really, I would say, nearly ill, and I think they must have had a very rough passage, either going in or coming back, whichever way it would, because Berlin was a very, very difficult target, as you can imagine, and but that did impress me tremendously about how rough they really looked because of the length of the flight. I'm not sure how long it would have taken, but that did stay with me a long time, and of course it was a bit worrying, to say the least. However, things eventually changed, and we in the meantime, because we were new to the squadron, the idea being that we would do some of the smaller trips. I think this was getting us acclimatised to working on the squadron. So it will be divided into three groups, where we start off with mine laying. Now, mine laying is in different parts of the where the coastal lines are, in the Baltic and different places, and they were all a question of going to a certain spot, dropping your mines in a certain area, and then just coming back. So mainly they were reasonably easy ones, because you very the only time you ever saw any ICAC actually was from naval boats that were in that particular vicinity. So that was the first thing we were put on, and then
do you remember anything about it? You seem to mine laying in the Frisians, mine laying off Le Havre, you know, a couple of things like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of them in particular? Or
no, there's nothing particular about those. Sometimes the flights were long, going to do quite. In fact, on one we went to was Bordeaux. You wouldn't think that would take a long time. I think we were all together about 7 hours, which sounds a long time. However, what I am saying about them, they were just a kind of boring type of operation. There's very little happens. I'm only talking generally. Very little happened during those, apart from the odd burst of flak from, as I say, naval vessels. So then they decided they were going to put us on, at the time, we were getting ready for the invasion.
And you joined the squadron, I think I may have said it wrong, you joined the squadron in November 43, I
yeah,
might have said 44.
That's right, yeah.
Sorry, you were getting ready for the invasion.
Yeah, and what they decided they were going to do, they were getting very worried about the buzz bombs, the V1s and V2s, were doing a lot of damage at that time, so they put us on a few of the idea was to go to where these places were noted in France that they were operating from. So I think we did two or three of those operations where we actually just put special duties on there.
Special target.
Special target. And those were the targets, was the due to the fact that at that time we sent a lot of aircraft trying to destroy where these were coming from. And this was mainly in France. So that was another type of operation.
And now, can we look at a typical one of those operations? So when would you first when would you first know you were on an operation? How would you first find out?
Well, the captain, the pilot is always the first to know, and he comes and tells the rest of the crew that as from such and such a time on such and such a date, we'll be going on operations, and then you attend your various instructions from the meeting where...
Now, what were the briefings like?
The briefings were very good. It depended, you see, on some of the information was very basic to just for the navigators and pilots. For the rest of us, the gunners and especially the wireless operator, the wireless operator was also given code numbers for various reasons.
Had
to come back again or whatever it is, or you're in trouble, or all kinds of different code numbers which were essential to if anything should go wrong.
And did they change every mission, or were they always the same?
The codings, they would do it according to the particular mission. It was never, I would say, a standard procedure. It was always a standard procedure to have instructions for as a wireless operator, like it was for the navigator and the pilots. And I think and also weather conditions were general, which was quite interesting. So from that point of view, then what was happening, we were approaching by this time getting into February. That was taking.
Hang on, we're on a typical raid still. So what happened after your briefing?
Well, after your briefing, you come back and you report immediately as a crew to a central place where these officers were going to relate and put down the record of each aircraft, what had happened to it. Was there anything that they saw during the course?
Hang on, that's after the raid, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's what you mean, isn't it?
So after the briefing?
Yeah. After the briefing, well, we each went in or got into our positions in the aircraft.
Right. So what would you be wearing? What was it? What was flying kit?
Well, flying kit was we had one of the fur-lined jackets, flying jackets, and I had like things like long johns for your feet and legs, and otherwise it was just ordinary shirt, and I'm not sure about anything else particularly.
Gloves?
But we did have gloves with us, yes, but they were only necessary to be used occasionally.
And what about on your head, flying helmet?
Well, we had a flying helmet on, yeah, but and that had to be kept on anyway because of the your hearing
your intercom.
So, I mean, that was worn virtually all the time.
So you'd go out, how would you get out to your aeroplane?
It will be taken from a certain point where all the briefing had been. They'd have these Land Rover type vehicles taking ready to take a group of you to the aircraft. And then once you got there, it was.
Now, did you have any superstitions before you got on the aeroplane?
No, never.
You weren't superstitious?
No.
Did any of the crew have any?
Not to my knowledge. Nobody had anything, a favourite thing to take with them, like some of them did.
Or not urinating on the back wheel or any of those things that crews did. You didn't. Your crew was not bothered by any of that?
No, not to my knowledge, anyway.
So when you got on the plane, what checks would you have?
Well, my check was definitely make sure where you've got your parachute on its hanger as it should be. That's already there, but make sure it's secure. And then, obviously, you test your set.
How did you do that?
It's just a question of tuning in a signal. You don't have to contact anybody. It was just a question of just making sure that things were working generally. Oh, excuse me.
And what's everybody else doing?
Well, the gunners don't do the testing until they're up in the air. Then they do a bit of a volley, making sure that once they're in the air, they were working. But as far as I know, the navigator was also working hard at his desk, plotting the course, which was already virtually done, I would think, beforehand. But he'd still be putting it all ready to operate. And he was testing other things in conjunction with the bomb hammer, because the two of them worked as a team, because sometimes he had to call on the bomb aimer for anything visual that might be handy for him when he's plotting anything. He's perhaps telling telling the navigator is probably telling the The navigator is telling the
bomb aimer.
Oh, sorry about
that. It's all right.
That.
Don't worry about it.
He's probably telling the bomb aimer definite things to inform him if they should see anything at any particular time. So that was the liaison there. The pilots and the navigator were also checking the instruments on the warm-up part of the aircraft, warming each engine up as as they always did. And And it was just became just general automatic routine.
So what was the takeoff? What was the takeoff procedure then?
Well, the takeoff is entirely between the pilot and the airfield people in the control tower. They contacted one another, and our pilots will be given an instruction of to what position they're going out, because you'd have perhaps maybe six or more aircraft all going out at the same time, or virtually, and so they go into a series of lining up in order, so that they knew who was going to be the first one to go. He would get into the right position before anybody else moved, and then so the second, and until all they were all lined up ready to go one after the other. And that was always done very efficiently as far as I was concerned. There didn't seem to be any real hold-ups. And that was, once you've got into the take-up position, it was just a question of the pilot getting the necessary revs for taking up and taking off, and that procedure being successfully, you were on your way.
So what would you do once you're in the air? What was your job in the air as wireless operator?
My job was primarily checking on my home station, only just listening. I didn't have to, once I was in the air, I didn't have to contact them until we were coming back.
So you kept wireless silence?
It was wireless silence, because once you're in the air, you've got to, we were always careful that the too much chatter on the key was picked up by the Germans very readily, especially when you cross the coast.
So you were listening to your home station, so, but saying nothing?
Yeah, that's right. But then once we left there, I was then tuned in to the reception I was getting from France or wherever you were going. You can pick up signals, and we were listening for the German types, which we quite often got hold of a frequency which you could hear the German instructions coming out. What we were allowed to do, and what we always wanted to do, if we did get any of that at any time, we could jam them. So what we did, we tuned into them, and once we got onto their frequency, all we had to do was then press your key down and keep it down for about a minute, and then release it. And then if the chatting was still coming back, you did it again. And that seemed as though it was a worthwhile exercise. Apparently it was fairly successful, especially if it was a night raid and you were likely to be attacked.
And did you have anything else to do as a wireless operator?
Only to get, if the pilot gave instructions that he wanted some confirmation about anything at all, which the navigator couldn't give him, he would ask me if I can find out about certain things by contacting, especially on the way home. You might be asked to confirm possibly I'm not quite sure on that now, because it's such a long time ago. It's just occasionally he might ask for you to do something.
So you'd break wireless silence then?
But it would have to be very serious, and what it would be, I think when we used to go out and we met weather conditions were very severe, if I hadn't got a recall, which I quite often got due to weather conditions which they knew we were going to meet, they'd call them back again. So that's why the listening was inevitable, to keep your listening procedure always. It would mean that I could then give the pilot immediate instructions as to what had come through, to tell the navigator and the pilot of what was taking place, and he would not, they would not automatically adjust the routes, etc.
Now, did you use your intercom much, as opposed to, yes. What was the intercom
used? The intercom was kept to a minimum, because once you're over enemy territory, again, it can be picked up in certain areas, but so you keep it to the minimum. If you wanted to contact a crew member, or if, for instance, we were attacked, obviously the ones that would then come into the character are the gunners, and the gunners, two of them, would be relaying what they could see, which the pilot couldn't see, which is like under the aircraft or behind or something. So all that was a coordination of what was happening at any one time. So they came into it, and I might have come into it, because I then, while I've still got my headgear on, I'm still looking through what we call the astrodome, and I'm looking for anything, signs of where what we've just passed over, what I've seen, and I could, if I'd seen something which I think the pilot should know about, we would do. I think one of the things that happened while I was watching at one time was the what happened when we were first hit. But if you want to carry on with that later on, yes.
So,
but
so you were looking out through the astrodome. Now, you were flying independently in a bomber stream, weren't you? So you weren't in formation.
No, not in formation. No, on these we were on our own. All the time.
Not in a bomber stream, even?
No. We were just individual aircraft going to different places. It wasn't like going on a one of these bomber raids where you're going out in literally thousands. We didn't operate that way.
So what would happen as you approach your target?
Well, all it was really, it was the bomb aimer would be checking on for an identification that they'd been given, what to look for, and he then related it to the navigator, who in turn altered course if necessary, and they eventually, once they'd found the identification thing that they were looking for, they then proceeded to come down to a certain height to drop their cargo of landmines. That's for the mining operation. Now, if it was not a mining operation, but an ordinary bombing would be, again, getting to the correct height to drop them, and then that would be, again, navigation and bomb aimer combining to get to the target where it was necessary to drop the bomb.
And while you were approaching the target, before the last time when you were shot down, were you ever? Was there ever any anti-aircraft fire or German fighters?
On the ones that we went to, the mine-laying ones, very little, very hardly any at all. On the other, the ones we didn't make much flak at all, on the ones we were going after, the V1 and V2 sites, we got very little.
So you didn't get much at all till you were actually downed, and no German fighters.
No, I don't think we saw one at all. No.
So what about the flight back?
The flight back was usually quite good, but according to depending on the weather. Weather-wise, sometimes it was a bit rough, but it was. Mainly, okay. If there was anything unusual happening on the way back, of course, we had to report it when we got back. But I don't remember much happening on those occasions.
So what about the approach to the airfield and landing? I mean, were you aware you might be attacked by German night fighters on the landing?
Well, we're always warned about this, yes, and there's not a great deal you can do about it. It's if there is, they will give you a warning from the airfield that there's likelihood of fighter aircraft are in the area, so watch out. But we didn't, I don't remember ever getting a warning at all.
So the landing, just routine?
Just routine,
yeah. Now what then? Hand over the ground crew?
Well, then we go back And we go back to where the officers were waiting, and we had to give a full report. The pilots and navigator, etc., did theirs and Bomberman, and I did mine with the radio operator, who was the reception officer. so it all went, as I say, quite usually. Not a great deal to really report.
Now, were you, before a raid, after or during, were you nervous at all? I mean, because some people are, some people aren't, you know.
I honestly can say I was never really nervous, but I must say here and now, because of the squadron I was on and the things that were happening, I was a very fortunate individual, because I never once went on a raid, what I call a bomber raid. And the reason is, and I have to say it now because you're asking, the reason is quite simple. When I got there in December, and I told you how the crew had appeared, they decided before that raid that we're going to take all Stirlings off main operations. Now, we didn't know this until we got there. Now, that, to me, I don't think we knew how to take it. We thought, well, perhaps we were being rejected as a, you know, and however, what they decided they were going to do with us, and this is when it came down to things like mine laying, what it amounted to was, because we'd lost so many Stirlings over the main targets, and it was decided at Bomber Command that they would be, and this was, a lot of it was due to the height, which we couldn't get, which was a very distracting thing with the people who had been on Stirlings and going through all the heaviest of bombing and things like that. They were at a great disadvantage and always were. So they decided then, and this was at the time we arrived, they'd stopped sending Stirlings out on the main operation. So it meant then that they had to create something for them to do. So A was what we've just said, was mine laying. And if it wasn't mine laying, we were going to do as much damage as we could to the French area, especially on the coastlines, of the preparations for our invasion and going after just the parts where things were happening by the Germans, getting ready for the defence of France. So we were attacking those. So those were the two main things that we were left with. And then the instructions came through just shortly afterwards to say that we would actually be being transferred en bloc to Lancaster's. Now that changed the thing again. I was really looking forward to this because I'd always wanted to fly in a Lancaster. The Stirling was a very good aircraft defence wise, but come height and things like that and other things, it would have been, I would really have loved to have flown. So
you heard that we were going to happen.
Yeah, before I was shot down, what we got the news through was definitely that within a matter of weeks from that date, which was sometime in February, we en masse would be supplied with Lancasters.